This is episode 17 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
All the way from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here and so are you, so let's chat with Carrie Coon. Suddenly I'm hidden, it's the darkness of the dawn, and your friends are gone, and your friends won't come, so show me where you fit. I'm going to hum along, and I am your host, Mary Larson. Don't you just want to hum along every time?
A little bit, yeah. If I had pitch or tone
you do not have pitch.
Any of that, I would.
You don't. Oh, my goodness. Well, as I said, everyone, I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and I love Carrie Coon. I may be a married man, but I love Carrie Coon.
I can stand by that.
She is amazing. And what you're going to hear in this interview, because as we have already done before, it's pre-recorded. She's charming. She's witty. She's very smart, open to any questions whatsoever. And she has some really, really interesting things to say about the character Nora Durst and almost like this split personality that she kind of has with her.
Yeah.
It's great.
It really, really is. This is a fun interview. I'm so excited for you guys to hear about it. So just as a reminder, this is part three of our three-part Emmy series interviews. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the other two, please, please, please take a look back at our first one, which was with Ann Dowd. And then our second part of this series was with Christopher Eccleston. So you can either listen to them on iTunes or through our website, thelivingreminders.com, or on Stitcher.
Any major podcast app that you can think of, we're on it. So you can find it all there. Man, I'm just excited for this interview. Are you ready to get into it?
Oh, I am.
Oh, let's bring on Carrie Coon. Let's do it. Joining us today is Carrie Coon, a Tony Award nominee and actress who has appeared in such shows as Intelligence and Ironside, and also starred as Margot Dunn in the unforgettable film Gone Girl. But we all know her as the enigmatic yet vulnerable Nora Durst on our favorite television show on HBO, The Leftovers. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us on The Living Reminders today.
Thank you.
First question is, how did you come to The Leftovers and what was the casting process like?
Well, I had just been nominated for a Tony for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and I had been sort of recruited by a larger agency, so I was going on a lot of general meetings, and I had met Ellen Lewis a couple weeks before the audition came up, and she's a Chicago gal, and she had me come in and tape for a couple of parts, actually, and then we got the call about a week later, I suppose, that Damon wanted to meet me for the role of Nora, and I expected I would have to do the sides again, but actually what it was just a sit down with Damon in Ellen's office, and we just got to talk and get to know each other a little bit, and I got to hear a little bit about his process and hear how smart and passionate he was about what he was doing, and he was also interested in meeting me because he pays attention to his actors, and if he's interested in an actor, that changes the story for him, so I think that's a very important part of his process is meeting us. And I expected after that meeting that I would have to jump through some studio hoops, you know, get approved by HBO and what have you. But in fact, a couple of weeks later, I got a call that I had the part. So I didn't have to do any additional testing or hoop jumping, which was pretty shocking to me because I, having been very new to television, I had heard all these stories about the sort of casting process, you know, ultimately when you have to test for a pilot or whatever you have to do, and none of that happened. So I still haven't been through it. knock on wood.
So what did you read for your casting? Was it something from the show, or was it something just totally written by Damon Lindelof that was outside of the show?
There was a scene between Nora and Matt, and it ultimately turned into that scene that Chris Eccleston and I do in, what episode is that? You guys know better than I do, probably episode 2, maybe. And there was a scene, I did the scene from the Meg scene, where she slaps the GR outside the house. So I read for Meg and for Nora. I think there was one other Nora scene, but I actually don't recall what it was.
Well, speaking of Christopher Eccleston, we actually had the pleasure of interviewing him just recently, and he'll be on our show as well. But what I want to know from...
Oh, he's delightful.
Oh, he's the best. And what I want to know from you, in one word, if you had one word, how would you best describe Nora and Matt's relationship? And ultimately, what was it like to play that with Christopher Eccleston?
One word to encompass that relationship? Oh, my.
That's why it's difficult.
So difficult. Is it a cop-out to say fraught?
No, I'll accept fraught. That's okay, too. And what was it like to play that relationship with Chris? Was it something that came easily?
Of course,
was it hard?
Yes, because Chris Eccleston is an exceptional actor. And because he's a listener, and he's changed by what you're doing. And that, to me, is very much what happens in the theater. I mean, Chris is a theater guy, and I'm a theater gal. So I feel like we meet in that space, somewhere that feels very theatrical and very much like being in a scene on stage together in a wonderful way. And he's so giving. Even when you're shooting your coverage, Chris Eccleston is giving you 110% of what he would have given you in the scene during his coverage in a scene. So it's an incredibly generous act to work with Chris, no matter what the content of the scene is. And I just find him to be as generous as you would think. He's just a really generous actor and a generous person.
Your character in that relationship in the book was extremely different from the TV show. What, if anything, could you pull from the source material?
You know, I'm a big believer in research stuff. Whenever I'm working on a play, I tend to do a lot of reading. I kind of come at things generally from a pretty intellectual place. So I actually find that even though so much of that material isn't in the show, it's sort of like if you were building a model of Nora, then the book material that you never see is sort of the spine. So you may see Nora's face and her voice and her hands, and you never actually get to see her spine. But I feel like the information that Tom Perata gives us in the book is so useful. You know, for example, you get a lot more information about her relationship with Doug, and you have that great scene with when she confronts Kylie at the dance, which of course we didn't get to do. But for me, when I have to shoot that scene in our show, even though you only see Nora slumped against the lockers, you don't know what's happened before she got to that place. So in my mind, that scene with Kylie could very well have taken place at that event. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, actually.
So I feel like it's actually such a rich world to play in, and I think it's tremendously useful.
One of my favorite scenes was that beautiful one in the coffee shop where Nora decided to push the coffee cup off the table. And we talked with the writer.
Yeah, we talked with Kath Lingenfelter about this scene, the writer.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, and we actually referred to you as Honey Badger, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
I was wondering why that started. I actually did. Somebody did tell me I was being referred to.
Oh my gosh,
as Honey Badger! But I didn't realize it started.
That was us.
That was us. Oh my god, that's amazing.
We just said Nora's Honey Badger. Honey Badger, don't care. I'm just gonna push off this cup.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Well, now you know. Now you know the source.
Wow, I am floored by this. That you actually heard this. This is amazing. Oh,
I did. What it meant for Nora, it's interesting because when I read that detail in the book, this was, of course, in the show, this was very early in the series. This is, I think, one of the first times we see her in the television series. And I remember reading that and thinking, huh, Damon, what's going on here? What does this mean? And I wanted to have a conversation with the writers about it. And I had some idea, but it was really helpful to talk to Damon because it sort of affirmed what I was thinking, which is there is an affirmation of her identity in that act. She knows that she's not going to get in trouble. in this community, because she knows everyone's looking at her, and she knows they're all thinking of her and pitying her. And I think she finds it quite amusing that she can knock over a mug in a coffee shop and somebody will apologize to her for it. And it's a kind of, you know, masochistic impulse, because it just continues this feedback loop of identity, her identity as grieving woman, as ambassador of grief in this town. And it's a pretty punishing identity to take on day to day. I mean, she intends it to be, I think, sort of punishing. In my interpretation, really entertaining, really amusing how people will behave around her. It's just, they behave in these really irrational ways, and I think she finds that sort of fascinating.
So with that in mind, then, how important is Nora's identity of Nora Durst to her? Is that something that she refuses to let go? And why do you think that is?
Well, I think we all do this. I know that, for example, my grandmother didn't work. One of my grandmothers didn't work. And so she identified for most of her life as a wife and a mother, period. Now, not to be reductive about the woman that she is. She's obviously a really complicated person. We all are. But her primary identities, the way she related to the world, were through the lenses of wife and mother. Now, Nora Durst, up to this place in the story, her identity has been that. It has been wife and mother in suburban America. And then suddenly that is yanked from her. And what is she left with? Well, the only thing she's left with then is grieving woman. And so I think, having clung to the identities of wife and mother for so long, once they're taken away from her, I think that's a tremendous paradigm shift, wherein someone, she doesn't know who she is anymore. And I think that would be true of any one of us if we were suddenly thrust out of the roles we're accustomed to playing. It's a really disorienting experience. And I found that struggle in her a very universal thing, something I thought people could relate to. You know, I read the book Wave by Sonali Dharyanagala. I'm going to butcher her name. God bless her. And she's the woman whose family was lost in the tsunami in Sri Lanka. And she lost her two children, her husband, and her parents in a matter of minutes, really. Wow. And the sort of insanity of that, of everything you know being taken away from you at once, I think you're going to end up clinging to whatever you can to just be a person in the world at all, to stay in the world at all. And I think it makes sense that, you know, in some ways what Nora is undergoing is actually quite liberating, because all of the obligations that you imagine that come along with these roles that you play are just that. They're not actually real. We are choosing to engage in the roles that we play. And very rarely do people consciously choose to divest themselves of those things.
Do you think she actually used that identity to her advantage? Like, I know we talked about the coffee cup and knowing that she wouldn't get in trouble, but in any other way, do you think she used that to her advantage?
Oh, I mean, surely. I mean, don't we all want to be acknowledged? Don't we all want to be acknowledged for existing? And how do we do that? I think most definitely she is performing grief out in the city, and I think it's very much, like I said, it's a performance of grief to get attention. Because at least if somebody's paying attention to her in whatever capacity, whether it's apologizing to her because she knocked over her glass, or looking at her with pity, at least she knows she's alive. And I think that's just about the only thing she has right now.
Did you read the script for A Guest and immediately know that it was going to be one of the best critically acclaimed episodes of television in 2014?
Oh my goodness, no. I read it and thought, oh shit, this is going to be really hard. I can't believe they trust me to do this. Because as I said before, this was my first television series. I had done guest star spots, but that's a day of work. I had never worked 12 days on a television episode with those hours and with this kind of emotional arc. I just had never been through that before. And Gone Girl, you know, you shoot Gone Girl for 3 months. That's very different than shooting basically what amounts to a short film in 12 days.
Wow.
So I was terrified. I was terrified, and also exhilarated. And And it was, but no, at no point did I think, well, this is going to be one of the most acclaimed episodes of TV this year. That never occurred to me. I'm maybe there are actors who think that way, but I don't know any of them.
You didn't read it and say, watch out, world. Here I come.
Yeah, no, I mean, gosh, I'd kind of like to meet that person and talk to them. If you find them, let me know.
Honey Badger is putting Hollywood on notice right here with guest. No, I personally loved that episode. I found that it was definitely for me one of the most intriguing episodes of television that I have ever seen, and you really came through and it opened my eyes as to what kind of an actress you are and what you bring to that role. And you actually spoke about Gone Girl, and you were wonderful in that as well. But you made such an impact in Guest that I had a hard time seeing you as anything else other than Nora Durst. It was difficult for me. Did you find? Have you heard that at all?
I mean, no, but I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will start to impact me when I try to get another job, when all they want me to play is like grieving women, which, you know, women are asked to play all the time anyway, long-suffering wives and whatnot. So I'm sure I'll have that problem once Leftovers is over.
And by the way,
my grandma always wanted me to do comedy. She's like, I want to see you do Born Yesterday. You know, my family thinks of me as quite lighthearted and funny, so this is all very perplexing to them.
And by the way, it's in no way a fault of yours. It's totally mine. Because
thank you.
Oh, yeah,
I take it as a compliment.
Oh,
I take
good.
It as a great compliment, what you said.
Great, because you just sucked me right in, and it was awesome.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And with that said,
I had great material. I mean, what an extraordinary thing to have given you, you know.
With that in mind, we had this really unique job with the departure benefits and something that I really didn't expect. And there was this really cool instance where everybody that Nora interviewed answered or checked yes to the question 121. Why do you think that happened?
Now, do you mean, like, why does Carrie think that happened? That what you're asking?
Yeah, why not? Let's see what Carrie says.
Well, what I find intriguing about that piece of the episode is that that's one of the reasons I think our show is engaging to the kind of people who are interested in those questions of faith and eternity and grief. Because I think an episode, I think that requires people to sort of say, huh, that's interesting. Well, how would I have answered that question? And why would all those people say yes to that question? Is it about them or is it about the person they lost? Is it about me or is it about, you know, what I think the person I lost was thinking? So I think it's just, I hesitate to answer it. I mean, in my personal life, I'm sort of on my own trajectory in terms of my faith, which I was raised Catholic, and I've certainly done a lot of questioning of that. And I'm not really sure where I land right now in my spiritual life, so I couldn't give a real concrete answer to that question. But I love that my show is asking that question. Mm-hmm.
We actually had this great theory that Nora was checking yes because that's what she wanted to believe for her family. And
oh, wow, that she was just doing
yeah, regardless of whatever anybody said, she was still checking yes.
Mm. That's very interesting. I'll have to ask Nora about that. To confront Nora and see if that's what she was up to.
I like this split dual personality. This is great. This is great stuff. Speaking of split personalities, there was also this unbelievable scene. Have you ever seen a crazy of a scene as the one with a hooker, a gun, a bulletproof vest, and Slayer playing at the loudest decibels possible?
I mean, certainly not any scene anyone was asking me to do. maybe that's a fault of our industry. But no, I mean that was certainly a wild thing to read. And of course, knowing the book and knowing that the most extreme Nora's grief gets is riding her bike a lot and watching SpongeBob SquarePants. This was quite a departure from the book. Pardon my language. Perhaps I'm misusing that word now. This is quite a departure from the Nora we meet in Tom Ferrata's novel. This is a much more active and extreme process that she's going through in order to hit this reset button and sort of start to feel again. So it was very intimidating, and I was wondering what viewers would think about it. But I take great comfort in the idea as an actor and as a person that basically anything you can imagine, somebody has done. And I think that's really important, that we go headlong into those moments in our art, because I believe in that. I believe that somebody has done that. Somebody's doing it right now somewhere.
So we hear that there was a little story behind you yelling at the author in the bar at the Drop Conference about how you decided to go off script and sit down at the bar to finish your drink. So we wanted to know what that scene was like and how that ended up happening.
Well, that's so interesting, because I remember, well, first of all, you guys, I'm sure, have also heard how sick I was during most of that week. And I can't remember exactly where I was.
No, we didn't know you were sick.
I might have been... Oh, I was really deliriously ill while I was shooting. We were shooting in a hotel, and during the lunch break, I would just go pass out in one of the rooms, and some, you know, PA would bring me a hamburger, and then we'd get back to it. And then every time we were shooting, they'd have to put an apple box for me to sit down on in between takes, because I was really ill, which is actually wonderful, because you really get out of your own way. So I think I was kind of coming out of my delirium when we shot that scene. And I remember trying it two ways. I had the suitcase, right? I'd been lugging the suitcase the whole shoot. I was ready to burn that suitcase when it was over. And at one take, Carl Franklin wanted me to take the suitcase, and another take, he wanted me to not take the suitcase. So I think that might have happened on... I'd have to look at the scene again, but I think I don't have the suitcase, so I went back to get it, and the martini was sitting there. And who leaves a perfectly good martini sitting on a bar? Nobody in my family does. So that was just, you know, that was really the only thing that that was different. I mean, I find it so interesting that people have latched onto that as being such an inspired choice. I love that. I mean, I love that. I love how people respond to that moment, to that impulse. But it certainly happened because I had a wonderful director who was really trusting and sort of left space for those things to happen, if that makes sense.
The reason why I think people latched onto it, because it just feels like Nora. It just feels like something that she would do and say, F you. Yeah,
Honey Badger. Once again.
Honey Badger just yelled at you in the middle of this hotel room or hotel lobby, and I'm still going to finish my drink. Drop the mic.
Oh, I love that. I love that so much. Well, that's incredibly flattering. Thank you.
You're welcome. And speaking of that Drop Conference, there was also, you had some fun with one of those loved ones. And what do you think was happening in Nora's mind at that time? Was she trying to live somebody else's life?
Well, you know, I actually think of it as hearkening back to something I said earlier in the conversation, which is about what's actually happened to Nora, if you think about it in a way that goes beyond grief and loss, is actually a kind of liberation. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I feel that having been sucked into this expected life of suburban housewife, nothing wrong with it, but that's just what she's been living. We get to see Nora like college Nora. I feel like those things are in her, and they have been sublimated for a long time because of the life she's chosen. And I think that it's kind of wonderful that we get to see inside of that a little bit as she starts to experience, when she's liberated from that identity of grieving woman at that conference, she gets to be a little more free. And it's actually more about, I think, rediscovering a person she was as opposed to becoming somebody else. And as for me, I mean, when we were shooting that scene, that was at the height of my illness. So that just felt like I was dreaming. That was the craziest day of my life. It's like, oh, there's an orgy, and now I'm going to hump a mannequin all in a day's work. But I was so deliriously sick that it felt like maybe I was not awake.
Oh, my goodness. So I
And Carl Franklin came over to me, and he said, okay, on this take, this was the humping the mannequin take. You know, Carrie, this take, I think we should really go for it. Just really go for it. And so we did it. And then he came back and he said, okay, I think that's as far as we can go. So that was really kind of great.
We're approaching Game of Thrones level here. Stop it.
Now, I want to know more about the scene with Holy Wayne. I want to know if it was as beautiful on set as it was on our screen, because that was stunning to watch.
Oh, thank you. I have to say, I think it was. And the reason it was is because of a few things. Patterson Joseph is an incredibly charismatic and present actor. And he made that scene much easier to do because he was so present with me. Secondly, B, our crew was extraordinary. We were up in this building in New York on some city block, I think on the Upper West Side or something, and they were so quiet and so respectful in between takes. They just sort of sat inside of that energy with us, so they were extraordinary to help us hold that space in the way we needed to hold it. And then also, Tom Noonan, he's the tall, you know, gangly ambassador for Holy Wayne in that scene. He's kind of a great old New York theater guy, and man, he's got such a mischievous and generous sort of soulful energy. And the two of them, being in the room with both of them, along with a crew who was so incredibly focused and so willing us to do our best work, it was just the right combination of elements to make that, I think, a really special scene. And of course, you know, being inside of it, you never know what something is going to look like. So it was very gratifying when it came out that people actually, that it seemed to provoke an emotional response in the viewer. I was very satisfied to hear that because you just never know.
Well, I think what sold it most was when Nora asked, "Will I forget them?" referring to her family, and it was just It was so innocent and so vulnerable. I think people really latched on to that. And whether or not Wayne's powers worked or not, or if it was just a Band-Aid, it seemed like it allowed Nora to get into relationship with Kevin a little bit more.
Yes, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because I believe that we hold a lot of our emotional traumas in our bodies. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things about Nora in that particular moment is that she hasn't been touched in a very long time. And really, when we see her with Holy Wayne, that's one of the first times we see her really touched by another person, literally, physically touched. And I think that's a really critical part of healing. So regardless, like you say, of Holy Wayne's powers, and I don't think Nora believes in Holy Wayne's powers necessarily, I think that did create space for some vulnerability. I think you're absolutely right about that.
In going in that light, do you think that Kevin and Nora, now that she is more open to having that relationship, do you think it's a good relationship, and can you amplify on it? And why do you think the fans cling to it so much?
I think what's good about their relationship is that it's starting in a pretty honest place, in a pretty authentic place, because they're so... They can't really start from anywhere else right now. Everything's been taken from them in the world physically. So I think any relationship that starts in that place is probably in some ways healthier, no matter how messed up two people are. So I actually think it's probably the only kind of relationship that would have any chance of being successful between two people that are that damaged.
You had a lot of emotional scenes throughout the season, but none as riveting as the scene where Nora discovers her family of loved ones. How did you get into that mental place to perform the way you did?
I have to, again, give some credit to Wave, that book by Sonali Dhirani-Igala, because it's so unsparing in its description of her loss and the insanity following her loss and the sort of the deepening of it even 10 years later, just how present that grief is in her life. And the way she describes the moment when someone described to her how they found her, which was with no pants, spinning around in the mud, just spinning. And that image was so haunting to me. And I wanted to try to honor her description of some of those things, which are, if you read the book, it's a really visceral book. You can't help but be impacted by it. But it's kind of remarkable that this woman is still with us when you realize the extent of what she's been through. So if you can, I guess I was able to open into that a little bit, into feeling compassionate for her. And also, I had finally met my family. I had finally worked with the actors who play my kids and my husband. And so I actually had some tangible people to lose when we got there. And, imagination. And also great editing. And also, I have to give Mimi Leader some credit, because I'll tell you, when that scene happened, I was making a really awful noise, actually. There's sort of a keening sound that I was making in all the takes. We probably did that about 8 times or so, I think.
Oh my
and
God.
Mimi decided to take the sound out, which actually made it more powerful. So I have to give her credit as the director of that episode for making that very powerful choice, which was not my choice. So it just goes to show how everybody working together can make something even more impactful than it might be, you know, without all those people making a contribution. So.
I can't believe you did that shot 8 times. I mean, and to
well,
eventually...
I mean, no, you got to get some coverage.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, to like... To get to that place and have that reaction, is that something you just had to like be alone and say, okay, I need to be
You know,
here?
I was. I actually, we were shooting in a house. You know, that was an actual house. So I was upstairs alone in between takes just to kind of keep myself. Because, you know, people have jobs to do downstairs. There's a lot of moving around. There's a lot of equipment. Everyone's trying to do their work. And so I would just take myself upstairs and then when they would sort of tell me gently they were ready, and they would let me come down the stairs in my own due time. And so that was great. Once again, I just feel like I was given a lot of space as an actor. No one was rushing you, and no one was, you know, laughing or stealing focus. I mean, everybody was, our crew was always really focused, and our cameramen were always really quiet and willing us to do the best that we could. And they were just as involved in wanting it to be honest as the actors were. And that was an extraordinary set to work on in that way.
In your final monologue, which was gorgeous, Nora writes to Kevin that she has to move on, but she doesn't want to forget her family. She can't let them go. But she still wants to move on. Why can't she let them go, do you think?
Well, I don't know that we ever let go of the people we lose. I mean, thankfully, I haven't had the experience of losing anyone immediate. But I've watched my grandfather lose my grandmother, and they've been together over 50 years. And I know that maybe because people are codependent, or because, you know, when you get married young, you grow up together, and so you become this binary creature instead of two individuals. You sort of are defined by what your partner is or isn't or something. I just don't know that we ever, I feel like those people just never go anywhere. I mean, my grandfather's never going to recover from the loss of my grandmother. I can't imagine one of my parents without the other. I can't imagine my life without one of my 4 siblings. And now I can't imagine my life without my husband. And I just can't think of a reason why that would ever change. And I can sort of relate to the idea, especially for Nora, that, you know, I loved the detail in the book that Tom wrote about Nora exploring the SpongeBob SquarePants episodes. She was rationing them because she was afraid that if she exposed herself to the SpongeBob scenes too frequently, that the memories associated with them would become less poignant. And I feel like the book Wave dealt with that too. It's like you only want to go into a memory so far because it could become a memory of a memory instead of feeling close to the actual thing. And so it's this weird, tenuous exercise of sort of pushing and pulling when you're trying to sort of hold someone in your mind that way. And so I think that.
Do you think Nora's story and indirectly The Leftovers as a whole is ultimately about hope?
I mean, I think, yes. I think humans are astonishingly resilient. And I think Tom was writing about, you know, he was sort of writing a metaphor for 9/11, this sort of collective grieving process. We keep going, no matter what. Sort of life will out. That's something my dad always used to say when I was growing up. He took that as evidence of God. He said, "Life, because life will out of any kind of destruction, out of a forest fire, out of a war, there's life will out from that." And I think that is what we're exploring in The Leftovers: the fact that in spite of this, these maybe multiple tragedies we keep experiencing in this show or re-experiencing, that you know, life life goes on is the cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason.
So if the departure happened in real life, like right now it happened, boom, how do you think you, Carrie, would react? Would you choose Faith, like, or the GR, or would you be like the rest of Mapleton and just kind of whistle past the graveyard?
You know, I've always been sort of obsessed with the apocalypse, so I would sort of probably feel like I saw it coming a little bit. And I think I would probably tend toward being pretty isolationist, actually. I think I would get pretty... I would probably overthink it a lot and spend a lot of time alone or with my immediate family trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
In a bunker somewhere, you know, like in Idaho.
Yeah, exactly. But I wouldn't be joining... I don't think I would join a group. And I think... Boy, I think thinking about religion would be quite a rabbit hole. And then I would go down, but alone.
Well, thank you once again so incredibly much for coming on and doing our podcast interview. I know that our listeners are going to be incredibly excited to hear everything that you've had to say.
Thank you. Let's do it again for season two.
Oh, my word. That would be amazing. We would love to have you.
Do
we don't even have to like podcast. You can just call us and we can chat. If you ever find yourself in Providence, we'll be here. We'll be hanging out.
You got it.
Wow. What an amazing interview. I still can't believe that she did that final scene at her house when she discovered her family 8 times. Ugh. She did that 8 takes. And I know she tried her best to describe the kind of mental place she had to get into in order to do it. And even though we got that explanation, I still don't know how she did it.
I would need like 3 days to mentally and emotionally recover after that.
And can you imagine trying to make that noise that she described making? And then all of a sudden, Mimi Leader, who is awesome, who we interviewed on our show, if you get a chance, go back and listen to it, just decides, we're taking that out. You know, we're going to, it's for artistic reasons. And while it was amazing, it was the right choice. So I can't believe how much goes into a scene like that. It's amazing, right?
It is. And that's why I loved having these interviews. They were so special to give us those inside scenes, those inside scoops into what happened that we as viewers didn't get to understand or really know about.
And how about the fact that she actually knew the Honey Badger reference?
Oh my God, my life is complete.
I just
a pop culture reference that we made somehow made it back to the person that it was about.
It was crazy. Oh my God, I'm just so thankful for that.
I know.
It makes me feel like at least 20 times cooler than I actually am.
All thanks to Honey Badger.
All right, my love. Before we close out the show, we have to give thanks to HBO, Carrie Coon, of course, and also good friend of the show, Brian, for helping us out with our questions. We couldn't have done it without any of them. So, would you like to close out the show?
Yes, you bet.
All right, let's do it. Well, everybody, that's our show for today, and it also serves as a nice tight little bow on our Emmys series interviews. Yes, it's unfortunate, I know, but we'll be back. We'll be back next season for season 2 of The Leftovers, and trust me, don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened.
Oh, so sweet.
Dr.
So,
Seuss so is the sweet man. He's very smart. And if I can quote him at any time, I will do my best to do
so. That was so. Dr. Seuss?
Yeah, it was Dr. Seuss.
No idea.
My boy's wicked smart.
Wow.
Wicked smart.
Well, in the meantime, if you're new to the Living Reminders podcast, or heck, if you just want to revisit and listen to those interviews and listen to our show recaps, you can at thelivingreminders.com. TheLivingReminders.com. And you can also find us on social media. So we will be making sure that you know of any and all updates that HBO sends out about this show. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. The handles for those social media sites are Living Reminders. Just one word, no spaces, Living Reminders.
And if you like email, you can reach us on livingreminders@gmail.com. And you're going to want to catch us on iTunes. So if you feel like you want to give us a 1-star rating or a 5-star rating, trust me, we prefer 5 stars. That's what I would like most. Please, if you like these interviews and you want to help support the community and get more people to recognize The Leftovers, give us a 5-star review and make us happy. It might make my night or my week. Also, you want to stick around, like we said, for the upcoming season this fall. We'll have a lot of recaps and analysis, as well as many more interviews, I promise, with the key members of the show, just like this one you've heard and the past two you've also heard.
Thank you guys so much for joining us for this special 3-part Emmy series. It has been such a pleasure. Let us know what you think. Shoot us a little message on our social media. We'd love to hear what you think. For now, I'm Mary.
My name's Blake.
And we're still here.